This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Union Jack on 17 selected days, instead of displaying the flag every day of the year. The flag dispute led to weeks of violence and a sharp debate over the meaning of cultural symbols like the Union Jack flag in Northern Ireland. Officially, Northern Ireland remains part of the United Kingdom, but longtime loyalists express fears of abandonment by established political parties. Northern Ireland is currently led by the pro-British Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, in alliance with Sinn Féin, the former political wing of the now disbanded Irish Republican Army. Some loyalists have gone so far as to call for dissolving Stormont, Northern Ireland's legislative assembly, and returning all government power back to London. More moderate unionists say the days of parading the Union Jack are over, including Trevor Ringland, who left union politics to join the British Conservative Party. He says the narrow definition of Ulster unionism, represented by Ian Paisley and the right wing, has hit its limitations in terms of who it can represent. In mid-February, the Obama administration released its final rule on disparate impact under the Fair Housing Act. The regulation formalizes a legal doctrine used for decades by civil rights advocates and the U.S. Justice Department to initiate lawsuits over discrimination against racial minorities, the disabled, and other protected groups. Using the disparate impact doctrine, the Obama administration won record settlements from big banks and mortgage companies. The Justice Department negotiated a $335 million penalty paid by Bank of America over practices by its subsidiary, Countrywide, which directed Black and Latino homeowners to higher-priced subprime loans while offering white families conventionally priced mortgages. Wells Fargo acknowledged charging Black families $3,000 more in fees and interest rates for loans in the greater Chicago region and agreed to pay a $175 million fine. Now, civil rights groups are increasingly concerned that the U.S. Supreme Court will overturn the disparate impact rule opposed by property owners, big banks, and insurance giants. According to ProPublica, federal officials pressured the city of St. Paul, Minnesota, to withdraw its appeal to the Supreme Court in a case applying disparate impact in housing. If the current conservative Roberts Supreme Court does strike down the disparate impact rule, it would severely weaken fair housing laws across the U.S. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Leaders of Native nations in both Canada and Oklahoma from the U.S. were among the speakers at the Forward on Climate rally in Washington, D.C. on February 17th, which saw an estimated 35 to nearly 50,000 people come together to demand that President Obama deny a federal permit for construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. The pipeline would transport dirty tar sands from Alberta, Canada, to refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast, mostly for export. The southern leg of the pipeline, already under construction in Texas, has generated powerful local opposition through groups such as the Tar Sands Blockade. Tar sands have a much bigger carbon footprint than other fossil fuels. Groups like the Sierra Club and 350.org, main sponsors of the Washington protest rally, have been calling on Mr. Obama to live up to his post-election pledges to tackle climate change and nix this project. One of the Native leaders who spoke at the rally was Jackie Thomas, a chief of the Sea Coos First Nation in northern British Columbia. She is a co-leader of the Yinka Dene Alliance, a coalition of First Nations and others working to stop the proposed Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline from taking tar sands from Alberta through British Columbia to the Pacific Ocean for export. In this excerpt from her talk, she addresses the problems tar sands extraction has already caused and about the alliances that are growing in Canada and the U.S. to stop the tar sands pipeline projects.
I am a mother of four and a grandmother of one, and I was raised by my own grandmother. She was a traditional medicine woman of my people, and I learned early on the value of our environment. And what she told us was, when we take care of the land would take care of us. If we destroy this land, we will destroy ourselves. I'm speaking on behalf of the Yinka Dene Alliance. We formed an alliance to stop the Enbridge Northern Gateway project, which plans to bring tar sands oil to the coast of British Columbia, which will then be put on tankers to go to the Asian markets. It puts at risk my neighbors to the east of me that live at the tar sands. The government doesn't recognize these people, and these people have been dying of mysterious cancers. Their water is polluted. Their animals are sick, and Mother Earth is sick. Our alliance have used our own laws to protect our lands, and for centuries, we've done this. We created the Save the Fraser Declaration. Currently, we have over 135 First Nations in Canada signed up to this. We have built alliances and will be signing international documents with other nations of the Indigenous world in the future. The Canadian government has been calling me an environmental extremist, a radical, and an enemy of Canada. All I want and my people want to do is protect this land and this water that is sacred. This water that we're talking about has no color. This water that we're talking about is not just water for my own people. It is water also for my neighbor ranchers, my neighbor farmers that live next door to me. It's a human issue, and it impacts everyone. We are all connected. Enbridge really has brought our communities together in Canada, because we've had oil spills, and you've also had oil spills in this country, because oil will spill. It's just a matter of when. They've spilt in the Kalamazoo. They've spilt oil in Red Deer, Alberta. They've spilt oil in my sister, the territories of the Lhuicon Cree. They've spilt oil in the Northwest Territories, the Dene brothers and sisters that I know from the Northwest Territories. And of course, who can forget Exxon Valdez? Never in my life have I ever seen white and Native work together until now. In Canada, First Nations are always expected to be the sacrificial lambs for our government in terms of the economy. Like the economy is a human being. Like the economy is more important than our land and our water. Water is a non-renewable resource, and we can't take it for granted. Under the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, the Inkatene Alliance have not given our free, prior, and informed consent to this project. In Canada, there's a judicial review process going on right now. While the process is still underway, our government has made public statements to the effect that this project will go through. Over the last year, my country has made changes to environmental laws that eases the burden for industry to discriminately go forward with these projects. We cannot keep taking out of greed. We should only take out of need. I'm here to ask you and to ask the world to help us. The Canadian government has made it clear they will approve Enbridge. We need your help to stand with us. We need your prayers. I need somebody to stand with me as the bulldozers come. I am laying down my life.
That was Chief Jackie Thomas of the Sea Coos First Nation in Canada. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about the issues related to tar sands extraction and the Keystone XL pipeline by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music, Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Lux's Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Benton County, in the heart of the Willamette Valley, is a lush, fertile valley where over 270 varieties of edible plants flourish. CSAs, farmers markets, and food co-ops all thrive in the county, creating a vibrant local food system that many farmers and citizens have spent their lives building. The valley is also one of the very few places in the world that can grow a wide variety of vegetable seeds, including many organic varieties, for the international market. But now industrial agricultural interests are seeking to turn the Willamette Valley into a breeding ground for their patented seeds and the chemicals that go with them. At the heart of this conflict is the question of who owns the seed, and thus who controls the landscape of agriculture. This morning we talk with Clinton Lindsay, a fifth-generation farmer and local food advocate from Corvallis, Oregon, who's working to pass a voter referendum that will create a food bill of rights in Benton County. Clinton works for Green Willow Grains in Tangent, Oregon, and he is the president of the board of the Ten Rivers Food Web, and also co-founder and steering committee of Benton County Community Rights Coalition. Clint, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start by talking about just how amazing the Willamette Valley is as a producer of food and the pressures that are just starting to happen to turn this valley into a producer of GMO crops.
What we have here in the Willamette Valley is a pretty unique seed-growing region. Like you said a minute ago, over 200-plus varieties of edible plants are grown here, many of them for seed. And the specialty seed industry, which is a thriving industry here in the Willamette Valley, is one of the guardians of this ability to grow seed for the international market. And we all are stewards of that seed. So to have it threatened by a form of agriculture that is inherently dangerous to seed production is a major threat, not just to the Willamette Valley, but to the whole world. I mean, this is one of five places where you can grow these types of vegetable seeds and do it well. And every other place that's they're shrinking, and this is one of the last places we can do that.
Well, what makes the Willamette Valley different from other places in the world so that it is possible to grow seed crops?
The climate and the soil are both perfect for this type of seed production. So it takes a special blend of soils and climate to be able to have that type of growing conditions, and we have that here in the Willamette Valley.
I also understand that there's another element that's been missing from the Willamette Valley that's been destroying some other possible seed-producing parts of the world, and that is that we are free of canola relatively free of GMOs. How much is that still the case, and how is that possibly changing now?
Well, that's true. Canola used to be grown here commercially, and they started to set up protected districts, the ODA did, when the specialty seed industry really took off. And so up until the past probably 8 years, there was no commercially grown canola. And canola is dangerous because it's both a fast-spreading noxious weed to the vegetable seed industry, and also now, as of this year, it's heavily contaminated by genetically modified organisms. Over 90% of the seed is contaminated by genetically modified traits.
So this is not canola that's been consciously bred to be GMO. This is theoretically conventional canola that's been contaminated by farmers, the canola grown by farmers that's GMO that's propagating with other non-GMO crops?
Well, one of the problems with once the biotech industry patents a given plant, in this case canola, it rapidly becomes harder and harder to find uncontaminated strains or stock of that seed, and that's the same with canola. So there's been arguments by people that want to bring canola into the valley that say, hey, we don't have any intention of planting GMO canola, but their argument doesn't hold a lot of water, because even if they were able to find a conventional strain, that strain would more than likely be contaminated by genetically engineered traits. So just bringing any canola in here by its very nature would be dangerous to the seed industry, but also, yeah, the threat of bringing in a genetically modified plant that spreads like wildfire is very dangerous to the seed system here.
Well, just one more footnote to the canola debate, which is we're not going to be focusing on strictly today, but it seems that in recent weeks there's been decisions on the part of the Oregon Department of Agriculture that are going to make it a lot easier for farmers to grow canola. Is that true?
That's right. The Canola Advisory Committee, or I should say the ODA, just basically made a permanent rule change after a public comment period where there was public outcry and a lot of public opposition to any proposed rule change, because the rule up until recently basically said within a box that was drawn over the whole Willamette Valley with some fringe bits outside the box, you were prohibited from growing canola within that box, except under special permit. Well, they didn't grant any permits. And so now they've proposed that they change the rule to shrink the district and allow permits. So as a